Up next, we are joined by Jillian Wilson from UC Riverside's Department of Astronomy. Jillian, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing very well. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Oh, you're welcome.
The first thing on everyone's mind, I think, is the lunar eclipse this week. I think we had a good shot of it last night or the night before. Now, a lunar eclipse, can you describe that to our audience really quick? What's happening when we can't see the moon?
When we can't see the moon, the Earth has passed between the sun and the moon. Usually we see the moon because we see reflected light, the sun's reflected light. And what happens is that the Earth blocks that light, and so the moon becomes dark.
And so when we go into a phase where we're getting lunar eclipses, it still takes a while before we start to see the complete moon again, correct?
That's correct, because everything is moving relative to each other. So, as the Earth moves in front of the moon, it takes a little while for the whole of the moon to be blocked, for things to line up perfectly, if you will. And then as the Earth keeps moving and moves out the other side, the moon gradually becomes visible again.
And how long would a typical eclipse phase last?
Oh, it lasts a few hours.
A few hours, but I mean where you're still getting a lot of the moon blocked out. Is it for about a week?
Oh, no. That's just a few minutes.
A few minutes. Okay. All right.
The whole thing lasts a few hours.
Well, one of the things I know we wanted to talk to you about is the discovery of, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, but probably Gliese 581, which is an Earth-like planet that was recently discovered.
That's right. Gliese 581, I think, is the pronunciation.
Okay. And where's this planet located?
This planet is, its's sun, the whole system, is about 20 light years from our solar system.
So relatively close when we're talking about astronomical terms,
relatively
right?
Close in astronomical terms, yes.
And with 20 light years being how far a beam of light will travel in 20 years, which while we currently don't have a way to travel at that speed, when people talk about space travel, usually light speed comes into the conversation. What is so important about finding an Earth-like planet?
Well, this is the first one we know of, other than Earth. It's actually not the first planet that's been discovered in this system. It's the sixth planet that's been discovered. But it's the only planet that's in the so-called habitable zone.
And would we call it a blue planet?
No, we wouldn't call it a blue planet. We actually don't know what color of planet to call it at the moment.
And what makes it, when we say it's in the habitable zone, what are some of the requirements for being labeled that?
So, of course, we don't really know what's required for life elsewhere in the universe. We don't even know if life exists elsewhere in the universe. But a best guess is that a planet that would support life would have to have liquid water. This would be essential. And so the habitable zone is a range of distances from any star over which liquid water could exist on the surface of a planet. So if a planet is too close to its star, you'll get some kind of runaway greenhouse effect, like Venus in our own solar system. If it's too far away from the star, it'll be too cold and liquid water would freeze. This is the first planet that's been actually given the moniker a Goldilocks planet. It's just the right distance from its sun that scientists think liquid water might exist.
So they speculate that liquid water would be there, but they have not yet found evidence of
that's
the water,
right.
They just think the zone is correct.
It's the right distance, and they can tell its mass from the little distortions it introduces in the orbit of its own sun. So they know it's the right mass. They think it's about three solar masses. And they know it's the right distance. So it's the right mass to hold on to an atmosphere, which is the other important thing. If it's too small, it wouldn't be able to hold on to an atmosphere. It's the right distance from its sun to have liquid water. But the scientists don't know at this point if it has an atmosphere, and they don't know if it has liquid water. But it's the right distance, and it's the right mass.
So water, atmosphere, any constraints on carbon?
We don't know at this point. I mean, carbon would also probably be essential.
But we're not. We don't know if there's any evidence of carbon
there's
there.
No, we know there's no evidence at this point.
Okay.
Now, what you would want, ideally, is to do some kind of follow-up observations. But unfortunately, I don't think this planet is going to be the right one to do the kind of follow-up observations that you would need to do to figure out details about the atmosphere. But there are probably, almost definitely, more candidates coming.
Interesting. And is there something that's spurring all these discoveries? Is there a new telescope that we're using to find these?
The discovery of this planet was actually made using the Keck telescopes.
So from a land-based...
They are ground-based telescopes on the Mauna Kea mountain in Hawaii. The reason that these planets have suddenly started to be discovered, and this is a very, very young field. When I was in graduate school in the early 90s, no extrasolar planets had been discovered. And the people who worked in this field were maybe considered a little bit strange. It wasn't clear that they would ever discover any extrasolar planets, so they were taking quite a risk. As of today, speaking today, they have discovered 500 extrasolar planets. This is the first planet in the habitable zone, and that's what makes this planet special. Now, what's coming in the future, what has actually been launched, is a new space telescope called Kepler. It was launched in 2009.
So this is sort of the follow-on to the Hubble.
Sort of a follow-on to the Hubble, except this space telescope is dedicated to looking for exoplanets. And it uses a slightly different technique than the group that found Gliese 581G. It uses a direct transiting method. So it's designed to detect planets as they pass in front of their stars, which causes a very tiny dip in the star's light. But this space telescope, it has to be in space to be able to make this sensitive a measurement, is designed to look for these tiny dips in the star's light. And it's actually monitoring 100,000 stars.
Wow. Which is, I mean, what percentage of that would that be of the night sky?
It would be a tiny, tiny fraction.
Right. It sounds like an incredible number, but really
you're asking me how many stars there are in the universe. Well, in our galaxy, there are 200 billion stars. That's just in our galaxy.
Oh, that's nothing.
But what you say that's nothing? But the main result to take away from the discovery of Gliese 581G is people up until the point of this discovery had only monitored worldwide. Teams had only looked at 9 stars. They'd been monitoring them for about a decade, and they found one planet in the habitable zone. That is an incredibly high fraction.
Sure.
That means that, you know, if you've looked at 9 planets, and if you looked at 9 stars and you find one habitable planet and you throw in our own solar system, so you've got somewhere then between 10 and 20% of stars have habitable planets, and we've got 200 billion stars in our own galaxy, that means that between 20 and 40 billion habitable planets exist in our own galaxy.
Right. Like you're saying, if it's 10% of these 9 stars result in a habitable planet, and let's say it was a smaller number, 1%, given all the stars
billions
that there are.
Billions, and that's in our own galaxy alone.
And this is reminding me of the movie Contact, where they make the point over and over that there's billions of stars with billions of planets and an awful lot of space out there.
Let me put it for you like this. There are 200 billion stars in our galaxy, and there's somewhere between 100 billion and a trillion galaxies in the universe. So there are likely to be more habitable planets than grains of sand on all the beaches on Earth.
And then the question is, are they inhabited, and would it be life that we would recognize?
Exactly.
And would that life be more advanced than us or bacteria?
Well, we don't know that yet.
Right.
But that's why this is a very exciting new field in astronomy.
Well, you're talking about new fields in astronomy, and not to draw you into a debate against other sciences, but astronomers are often credited for discoveries with their instruments in addition to the discoveries that they make with those instruments. So, you know, you think of Galileo's work with the telescope, or people often say the reason astronomy has advanced so far so fast in comparison to other sciences is because the scientists themselves are so involved in building and developing those instruments.
Well, that's right. And the reason that this ground-based discovery was made was that one of the members of the team, Steve Vogt, at UC Santa Cruz, had been really pushing for many years to improve spectrometers. And because he made strong advances in the precision of the spectrometer that he uses, he was able to measure this tiny wobble in the host star and infer the existence of this planet.
Interesting. And, you know, we often think of the astronomer being somebody looking through a telescope of some sort, and we're thinking of the old pirate telescope on a grand scale. But with the long distances involved, where you're trying to find just a wobble of light to infer that there's a planet there or that there's gravity there, there's a whole array of tools that they're using. You mentioned the spectrometer. There's people who do astronomy through radio waves. What are some of the different ways that people make these types of discoveries?
Are you talking discoveries
of planets?
Of planets?
Yes.
Well, there are quite a few techniques that have actually been shown to work to discover planets. There's this radial technique where you have to improve the precision of your spectrometer. You can also detect planets from gravitational lensing, where if you can measure, this way you measure a very tiny change in the luminosity of the host star.
Any other ways that come to mind? Or are those the two primary ways?
There are a few more. The most planets have, exoplanets have been discovered using this wobble technique that I talked about, but this new transit technique, which is a direct technique, is going to take over the field. Because the host star is so bright compared to the planet, one of the ways of trying to find exoplanets is by blocking out the light from the host star. It's called coronography, and some exoplanets have been discovered that way. Another way is pure astrometry, just the Doppler, the radial velocity technique I'm talking about, measures the wobble of the host star along the line of sight. There are astrometry techniques that measure the wobble of the star in the field of the sky, against the wallpaper of the background stars, if you will, moving a little bit back and forward.
And this would differ, and this is because of the great distances involved, whereas the planets in our own solar system, you can see them just with strong lenses, correct?
The planets in our own solar system, you can see many of them move just with the naked eye against the background wallpaper, and that's purely because the range of motion is so great because they're closer to us. Yes.
Sure. Now, I also wanted to ask you, on when we were talking about the moon earlier, there was a story I think I saw about a large amount of water vapor found on the moon. Did you see that?
Oh, yes.
That's a pretty big discovery.
That is a very big discovery, and actually quite unexpected.
And were they thinking it would be too cold there?
Well, you know, in the 1960s, astronauts from the Apollo mission brought back lunar rocks. And when scientists studied these lunar rocks, they were found to contain very little water. So it wasn't quite clear what is going on. I mean, the theory of how the moon formed is that it formed billions of years ago when a Mars-sized planet actually crashed into Earth.
Sort of an expulsion of Earth.
Right, and this impact stripped away the Earth's outer layer and sent it into orbit, and gradually the pieces coalesced under their own gravity and formed the moon. And it was thought that quite possibly heat from all this you know, from this collision and then the coalescing had vaporized most of the water in the lunar material, so that the water was just lost to space. But some scientists thought there was still a chance that water might be found in some special places on the moon. In particular, it was hoped that in deep craters at the lunar pole, that here water might be able to be trapped, because it's very cold. These craters are in permanent shadow. The sun isn't shining on them. And there was a chance that there might be ice there, water ice there. So NASA was convinced, and last year they deliberately slammed a rocket into one of these deep craters and then analyzed the debris thrown off. And sort of the most optimistic scientists were hoping maybe 1% of the material thrown off would turn out to be water. It turned out that once they analyzed their data carefully, that 6% of the material was water.
Interesting.
And the analogy they make is this is twice as wet as the Sahara.
Now, is this found sort of on a crater on the dark side of the moon, or is it
it's on the exposed side, but it's just in a deep crater, and the angle is such that sunlight doesn't get down into the crater.
Okay.
Now, of course, it's of great interest. It's not just a scientific interest. There are implications if you're hoping to colonize the moon.
And many people do talk about a moon-based colony if you're trying to make a launch to Mars or to more distant planets.
Right. Right. It has been estimated that the cost of taking a bottle of water to the moon is $50,000. So it would be much cheaper to mine water there than try and take it from Earth.
But
of course, you have to have water there, and it wasn't known until this recent result. At least it wasn't known so convincingly that there is actually water that can be mined on the Earth.
But as you say, it's just six times more than the Sahara Desert.
Well,
so it might be an undertaking to do it.
Extrapolating from that, the scientists who did the analysis have concluded that in the whole crater, this was just the impact from the rocket. If they consider the whole crater, there are billion gallons of water in there, which would be enough to fill 15,000 Olympic-sized swimming pools. So you say a little bit of water. I mean, 6% adds up.
Not bad.
They also found some other elements. They found calcium, magnesium, mercury, silver, and gold. So there might be other mining to be done on the moon.
Well, that would make it more viable.
Right.
And where are we at on colonizing the moon? It seems to go back and forth with each administration. Do you know what the latest is from the Obama administration on a mission to Mars?
The latest from the Obama administration is that the space agency's previous moon-oriented goal is now to be scrapped, actually, despite finding the water, at least for now. The Obama vision is to have a manned mission to an asteroid by the year 2025, and then a manned mission to Mars sometime in the 2030s.
Manned mission to Mars via the moon or via the asteroid?
Via the asteroid.
Interesting. And
also, the International Space Station is going to keep being funded through at least 2020. So there are a variety of choices. It's not necessarily particularly clear which route might be taken. And the problem is always the problem, which is the problem of money. He assigned his vision into law, but Congress have not passed his budget.
Okay.
Yet. And in fact, this month they signed an interim budget. So nothing is sure at the moment, and everything is up in the air.
Well, speaking of money from NASA, though, UCR just got a grant from NASA for some research, correct?
I'm not sure which grant you're referring to.
Oh, I thought we had...
We have small grants from NASA.
Okay.
To do various research projects. But no one's giving us billions of dollars.
billions
of dollars.
Not
that I've heard of.
No, I think it was tens of thousands of dollars, I think, is what I saw.
Yeah, I hold a couple of grants.
Okay. The moon, is it unique that the moon for Earth doesn't rotate on its axis, that we're always looking at the same face of the moon, or is that pretty common with moons?
It's quite common, actually, and indeed I should have mentioned that this planet is so-called tidally locked, this planet that has been discovered, which makes it quite interesting because one half of the planet is frigid and one half is torrid, which sounds pretty bad at first, but then you realize that there's a range of stable temperature zones in between. They've been referred to as eco-niches. So if conditions were right, then life, some kind of life, could sort of choose, and indeed different kinds of life, could choose the temperature that they like best, and you might get different kinds of evolution.
Interesting. So,
we asked about the moon and our Earth. I mean, it's common even in our solar system. There are other planets that are tidally locked in our solar system, and in fact, Pluto and its moon are tidally locked to each other.
Well, you just brought up Pluto, and Pluto goes in and out as to whether or not it's a planet. What is the latest on that?
It was voted out.
Voted out as a
unfortunately, and I'm one of the astronomers who feel this was quite unfair. Pluto is no longer considered a planet. It has in 2006, it was considered to be a dwarf planet rather than a planet. So now, there are now only 8 planets in our solar system. If you grew up thinking there were 9. The astronomers have reclassified Pluto as a dwarf planet.
Well, and it used to be that there were 9 and thoughts of a planet X or a 10th planet.
Right.
But then Pluto was taken out of the mix. And when they call it a dwarf planet, are they saying it doesn't orbit the sun?
No,
or that it's just more like a moon?
They're just saying it's less massive than the other planets.
So it's purely, so it's very similar to any of the other planets other than its size.
That's correct. And in fact, the IAU, this is the body that defines planets, has 5 dwarf planets in this category.
But only
it's not just Pluto.
So other ones in what we would think of as our solar system, even
in
though
our solar system.
Okay.
And these are so one of them is a massive asteroid. Things like that.
Okay.
It's purely mass, a mass-determined term.
But it must have been a fairly newly defined way to look at what is a planet.
Right.
For it to be voted out.
Right.
Pluto, similar to planets in that it's still a spherical body, still orbiting the sun in a regular fashion.
That's right. That's
okay.
Right. It's because you know, astronomers make discoveries, and they discovered some of these bodies beyond Pluto. So originally there was thought to be a 10th planet. Now that's not thought to be the case, but there have been some other massive bodies discovered in orbits beyond Pluto. And unfortunately, these have about the mass of Pluto, and in fact, in some cases, multiples of the mass of Pluto. So then it was a bit embarrassing because how can Pluto be a planet, but these things aren't a planet?
Right.
So they reclassified Pluto and some of these other bodies.
Now, while we have you, I am curious if you have an opinion. You were talking about a mission to an asteroid, and I know that there are a lot of movies about asteroids wanting to come into contact with Earth, global killers, or you know, movies like Deep Impact, where we see the asteroid coming and there's very little that we can do to get out of its way.
Right.
And I think that there has been some funding in setting up an early warning of this type of thing.
That's true. And I actually would be quite worried because we know it has happened many times in the past. And we know it is therefore likely to happen in the future. So it's something to be, you know, if you were a dinosaur...
You'd be a believer.
You'd be a believer. And we talked earlier about how the moon was thought to form because of a Mars-sized asteroid hitting the Earth. So this happened, and it happened 65 million years ago for the dinosaurs, and depending on the size of the asteroid, it could be quite catastrophic.
And so what does the research that the Obama administration is putting forward in thinking they want to launch a mission from an asteroid, does that play into an asteroid defense of any kind? Or is
these are sort of unrelated things. I mean, using an asteroid to launch into deep space as a base is a different issue from trying to figure out which of the many asteroids that exist in the solar system might be one that was on a collision course with Earth.
Sure. I would just think practicing the techniques to land on that asteroid or...
But you're assuming that the way to get rid of an asteroid that's on a collision course is to land on it.
And it may not be.
Well, I would say personally the most promising technique that I've heard of to if you identify an asteroid that's on a collision course, the promising technique that I've heard of, I mean, the next thing you have to do to deal with is what do you do with it? And an interesting proposal that has been put forward is that you actually very gently and slowly put some other kind of mass next to it, some kind of spacecraft, and it's been called a gravity tractor. You can slowly divert the path of the asteroid without trying to blow it up or do anything as dramatic as that, just by putting a mass near it and towing it out of the way with gravity. Of course, it depends on the size of the asteroid, how long this would take, but certainly, to me, an interesting proposal.
And if you could nudge it early enough, you wouldn't have to nudge it very far.
And that would be why it would be important to identify the asteroids that could be dangerous as soon as possible, because then you would have more time to perform some kind of tractoring maneuver.
Now, there is a known belt of asteroids, but in our solar system,
Mars and Jupiter.
Is this where we worry about that type of threat, or are those ones smaller than the ones we would normally worry about?
No, that's one of the primary threats. There are other regions of asteroids, but that asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter is one of the main regions where one of these killer asteroids, if you will, could come from. They bump into each other every so often, and they get bumped out of the asteroid belt, and they can start flying towards Earth.
We have been speaking with Jillian Wilson, who's an astronomer at UC Riverside, about all of the fascinating work that astronomers do. It's much more than just looking through telescopes. There's all kinds of tools that they use to discover planets, and sounds like we're on the verge of a great many discoveries. Before we say goodnight, I did want to ask you, you were talking about the Hubble telescope, the Kepler telescope, and even the Keck Observatory on Hawaii discovering these exoplanets. If you were going to make a guess, given all these tools that are coming online to find planets that might have life, would you guess that we, over the next 20 years, might find life that we discover? Or would you guess that that's still too soon?
I think it would be hard to find life in 20 years. What we can do in 20 years is we can identify some of these habitable planets, and then we can follow them up. If we can get planets that are passing between their suns and us, so these transiting planets, then we can use the light from the sun as a flashlight to illuminate the atmosphere of the planet. And we can actually examine that atmosphere, break it down by wavelength, and look for evidence of atmosphere. We can look for things like water in the atmosphere, things like this. So we would get more clues about whether life as we know it would exist on these planets. How you definitively find life, well, I think you have to go and look, right?
You have to get there.
It's 4 light years to the closest star. So it's going to take quite some time.
And how long would
Even if we identify likely planets.
Using the transportation that we have now, how long would it take to get 4 light years?
Well, assuming you go in person, of course. Uh-huh. There are programs that have been going for many years. SETI is a famous one. You mentioned the movie Contact.
Right.
Where you just look for signals. You hope that there's intelligent life, and you hope that it's signaling at Earth, and you can pick up the signal.
And it
you ask how long it can go to a near, how long it would take us to get to a nearby planet, but maybe you don't need to go. Maybe you can be lucky or clever and pick up a signal.
And what do you think about that in the debate between either discovery through instruments like Hubble or Keck or manned spaceflight or unmanned spaceflight? Do you have a strong feeling about one being more important than another or some being unnecessary?
I think we're just we've evolved to be curious people, and I think we'll try them all. There's a Calvin and Hobbes quote, which is the surest sign that intelligent life exists elsewhere in the universe is that it has never tried to contact us. But I think it's just human nature. We'll look in all possible ways. And Stephen Hawking has said it's not very smart to look. You should be very quiet and hope nothing more intelligent than you finds you, right? You should just hide under a pillow or something.
We should make sure we're not sending radio signals out.
It's clear that's not what's going to happen. Scientists are going to try all sorts of ways, and probably ways we can't even imagine today.
Well, thank you again for sharing the time with us to talk a little bit about all that goes on with astronomy. Hopefully we got some listeners interested in the night sky. We've been speaking with Jillian Wilson, who is an astronomer at the University of California at Riverside. Thanks again for joining us tonight.
Thanks very much, Chris. It was my pleasure.